You're listening to the Surf Simply podcast, bringing you news and opinion about surf culture, characters, coaching and competition from the team at the Surf Simply Coaching Resort. For more about Surf Simply's video coaching courses, go to surfsimply.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to episode 51 of the Surf Simply podcast. We're recording on Monday, November the 6th, 2017. My name is Harry Knight, and with me today is Rue Hill.
Hello, everyone.
Asher King.
Hello, Webland.
And Will Forster.
Hello, everybody.
And we are back. We're back from our little autumn, fall, vacation, holiday thing, depending which side of the Atlantic you come from.
I think we've got quite a few laps of the earth that's in air miles between us.
I think I hit five countries in 2.5 weeks, but only very shortly, because I'd spent most of the time in California or the UK, but I did 2 days in France and 4 days in Portugal as well.
Was that 2 days stopover in France, as in you were just, that was just the practicality of travelling?
No, my my girlfriend's parents came over to the UK and we did a sort of whistle stop tour, but her dad was really interested to go and see the Normandy landing beaches in France, and so we got the ferry over. We did the night ferry, so you sleep on the ferry, and then did 2 days and one night in France, then did the night ferry back again.
Did you walk down the beaches of Normandy listening to a Hans Zimmer's Slow Down Nimrod by Elgar, you know, the theme tune from Dunkirk? That's what I would have done.
I like how you had the exact name of the theme song just on hand, unrehearsed.
I've been getting really into Hans Zimmer because he did the Interstellar theme tune as well, and he also did the soundtrack to Blue Planet, but he's my new working music on Spotify.
It is also Dunkirk's 100 miles east of what was the theme music? Did Hans Zimmer do Saving Private Ryan?
I don't know.
Because that is the Normandy.
He's been like a pretty prolific, epic movie soundtrack guy.
Yeah.
In college, when I would be up in the middle of the night studying, I would always listen to
Gladiator.
His soundtrack.
Now We Are Free.
Pretty much the Inception soundtrack, which is just.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah,
it's a good one.
Time on the Inception soundtrack. That's on my Hans Zimmer Spotify playlist as well.
And yeah, while I was in California, I ended up going up and hanging out with Rob Case up in San Francisco, which is really cool. And doing the, for listeners that haven't heard, we have an interview with him in a previous episode, and I'll link to that in the show notes. But he's the guy that is kind of the paddling specialist. And I jumped into the sort of endless flow pool thing and had him analyze my paddling, which was really cool.
And you said that after you left, he sent you a really good email linking to videos he'd done that were online that were specifically relevant to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I think is great. And as regular
really cool
listeners
idea.
To the show will know, we're kind of working on not just our new tree of knowledge, which is now, if you just type Surf Simply Tree of Knowledge into the interwebs, it will pop up right at the top and you'll find a place where you can download it for free as a poster. But we're also working on an interactive version online where there's going to be a page for each skill and then ultimately a video for each skill as well. So hopefully that's something we can aspire to do too.
Yeah, I think so. Will, where did you go traveling? You've hit a couple of countries, haven't you?
Yes, so Jesse and I went
to... Well, you guys went to Peru.
We went to Peru first, yeah, we coached in Peru, which was awesome. We had two groups meet us down there, and we got some pretty cranking Chicama, which was very fun. But we also, Jesse and I left Peru and went to El Salvador. We went to Las Flores for a week, and somehow timed it with pretty much like the swell of the year there. It was the same swell they ran the Puerto contest, and it was incredible. It was well overhead and just the most amazing round, long, it kind of was like epic J-Bay, but El Salvador.
You were saying that was some of the biggest waves that you've got anywhere.
Yeah, biggest, perhaps the biggest I've seen in person, and you know, by default, the biggest I've ever surfed as well. So
we surfed that same swell, but a week apart on different sides of the Pacific.
Yes, we did. Yeah,
it was pretty crazy.
Yeah, and then from El Salvador, Jess and I went to the UK to see my family, and then we had a few days in Paris before coming back to Costa Rica. So a big trip.
Delightful.
Yeah,
delightful. And Asher,
cool.
you went to Peru as well.
Yeah, I was in Peru as well, and I had a really good time down there. I think the second time I've been to Chicama, and I think we got it the best I've seen in Peru this time. The sandbars are really good. It's all sandpoints there, and it's really dependent on the offshore currents and kind of whether the sand is ebbing and flowing. And yeah, this was definitely the best I got it. And afterwards, I went down into Chile. I've always wanted to go down to Chile. I've spent a bit of time in Argentina and never was able to do the jump over the Andes. And yeah, that's maybe my new favorite country.
And how did you find surfing in the 5mm suit that I lent you?
Yeah, so that was the I've never worn a suit that thick. I've worn like a hooded 4.3 in North Carolina on the East Coast. But man, a 5.4, you feel like the Michelin man.
It's pretty hard trying to paddle.
It's pretty hardcore. And it was, yeah, the waves that I was surfing down there, it's really open ocean and it's really raw and really, really big surf. So to surf in waves that size with a 5.4 on, I got a lot of respect for the guys that charge like Mavericks and Mugglemore in waves like that, because it's another level in that thick of a suit.
I find that once I've gone like a three two, I don't feel like it's too prohibitive, but once I get into like a 4 or a 5mm suit, it really kind of slows me down, and I feel like, oh, how can anyone be expected to surf in this? And then you see, you know, footage of what's his name, the Canadian guy that you always see surfing,
Pete Devries.
Yeah, and he's, you know, he's just ripping.
Yeah, it, I don't know.
It's almost definitely me, not the suit.
Yeah, his summer suit is like a 6mm.
Yeah, it's almost as once the suit gets to a certain point, I don't know. It's just the surfing is different. The mindset is just so much different than paddling out in Nassara, for example. It's just so easy to surf here. It's like I walk out behind my house. I'm like, oh, waves are just fun. And I run out for a 30-minute surf. And there it takes about 45 minutes to get ready for a surf.
Yeah.
It's like putting on wet boots takes ages. But
oh, wet cold boots is one of the horriblest things, other than a wet cold rash vest.
Or yeah, wet cold 5.4 is pretty difficult to get into. But yeah, it's the waves were so good that I don't know, it was worth it. It was like surfing really big Uluwatu, but with instead of 400 guys, it was 4 guys out. It was almost like I needed more people out because it was a bit nerve-wracking.
Very cool. And you went to Cloudbreak Roo?
Yeah, and much as I would have liked to have been charging those waves with you down in Chile, temperature notwithstanding, I got some of the biggest waves that I've ever had out in Cloudbreak, and I was kind of wishing that you were there. And I had a little bit.
We gotta link those up.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I went out to Tavarua for I guess a week, and actually I stayed on the mainland of Fiji for a few days before and got some really fun waves there. Surfed at this spot called Frigates, which is, I think it's like 24 kilometers offshore, just this reef right out in the middle of the ocean, which I've not done before. So that was kind of surreal. There's nothing to line up with. So when it kind of goes flat, you're just sitting in the middle of the ocean and there's no points of reference anywhere. And then, you know, a set will come in. And I arrived over in Tavarua after a few days and the forecast didn't look that great and it was raining. And I was thinking, oh, well, you know, I kind of like struck out here. But never mind, at least I'll just have, you know, a week on an island just kicking back. And then they'd put me in a shared bungalow, like as in a shared bedroom with this other guy. And I was kind of feeling like if there's no waves, and I didn't know I was going to be in a shared bedroom, and maybe I'll just go back home and hang out. If it's going to be raining, I might as well just hang out at home, you know, and get some waves out the front of my house. And then I thought, well, I can't do that because then people will go, how's Fiji? And I'll have to go, oh, well, I got in a grump and it came. So I better just stick around. Anyway, the guy I was sharing a room with ended up being this awesome guy. Have any of you guys seen Teen Wolf, the TV show? I think it's...
Funnily enough, no.
Maybe once or twice.
Anyway, I hadn't seen it either. But anyway, he's the actor that plays the dad in Teen Wolf, a guy called Lyndon Ashby. But
no
like
way.
A super nice guy, really good. And he surfs amazing. And anyway, so he was great. And then, yeah, the sun came out and the swell picked up and we had cloud break, you know, like 3-4 times overhead every single day, Monday through Friday. And then we left on the Saturday morning. And even the Saturday morning when I left, it was still, I don't know, just like the biggest surf that I could surf. And, it was amazing. And Tavarua is an interesting setup because restaurants right close to the island picks up a lot less swell than Tavarua. So on the island, you can fit about 70 people and it was completely full when I was there. There's a lot of families and kids. So there's probably like 30 or 40 surfers. And of those 30 or 40 surfers, most of them had one or two sessions out at Cloudbreak and then didn't feel that comfortable with the size. So they'd be surfing restaurants right close to the island, which is, you know, waist to head high. And at low tide is like Chopu shape. And at high tide is this really mellow, like longboard wave. So they'd be kind of surfing it on whatever tide they felt comfortable. And I was out surfing at Cloudbreak with, I don't know, like a lot of the sessions with like 2-3 other people. And I remember by the Thursday, I just couldn't even lift my arms. I got out of bed and I was just like, oh, it's 8 foot and offshore and uncrowded and pumping for like the fifth day in a row. And I can't even paddle. I can't lift my arms. So I had an amazing trip in the end. And there was a lot of awesome people that I met out there. So I was traveling on my own. So it was really nice kind of meeting some cool families out there who like welcomed me into their fold. Yeah, it was a pretty special trip. I think we should definitely do a Team Simply trip back out there sometime.
Oh, I'd love to. Mm.
Did you drink any of the cava?
Yeah, so we did the big circle thing at the end. They have the tradition where everyone sits round, and then like the local kind of the people who live on that island, not really a family, but they do the big dance and there's like a ceremony and all of that. And it's not a religious thing. It's just a traditional thing. And everyone drinks this cava root, which tastes like room temperature muddy water. With a little bit of actual mud in it. It's the most disgusting thing. And I kind of like sat to the side so that they would go around the circle. And I sat over with like the photographer and some other people that are there all the time so they didn't get involved. And then they spotted me and they kind of like came all the way through to the back and made me drink one. And it's pretty disgusting. But I washed it all down with a bottle of white wine with one of the Australian families that I met out there. So it all was fine.
While we've been off air, The couple of little things that have happened. Surfline has bought Magic Seaweed, which now gives them pretty strong dominance over the surf forecasting vibe. Kelly Slater has announced that the first of the public wave pools made by his company is going to be in Palm Beach in Florida.
Three cheers for that. There I'm a happy go. Floridian that there's going to be a Kelly Slater wave pool a couple hours from my hometown.
There we go. And the WSL has agreed to take on the Mavericks contest from the cartel management and the Titans of Mavericks. It's now just going to be part of the Big Wave World Tour. So that's all pretty exciting.
So does the Monopolies Commission not stretch to surf forecasting apps?
I guess not.
Now, that's a bummer. I always feel like a little bit of competition's not a bad thing, you know, keep each other honest sort of thing.
Yeah, I wonder what happens to Magic Seaweed's algorithms now that Surfline owns them, because they interpret data much different.
Well, Surfline has its, they have their own sort of forecast model running through computers, don't they, Lola? Mm-hmm. So I imagine that they'll probably just keep them separate. It's just that all the advertising will be linked.
Yeah, it's kind of like when Google bought Waze, you know, they still kept them pretty separate.
The Surf Stitch monopoly is crumbling. Magic Seaweed got sold off. Stab Mag got sold back to the original owner. Sam McIntosh owns it again. So they kind of just, yeah, I would hate to own shares of Surf Stitch.
Although maybe they're cashing out. I don't know.
I think they plummeted. I think they actually had to freeze trading on it because it dropped so fast. Like, I think they bit the dust.
I wonder if that's the same reason. I wonder if Magic Seaweed has got kind of declining profits and that's why they've sold to Surfline.
Well, Magic Seaweed was part of it. Was part of that whole.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the guys who own Magic Seaweed cashed out hard. I think they made a bunch of money on it.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
The Magic Seaweed app is super frustrating to use because it logs you out every time you don't use it. And then every time you want to just click it and open and see what the surf's doing, you have to log back in and then find your location again. You can't just like leave Player Guiones open and just open it and shut it.
No, mine doesn't do that. But
maybe it's me.
Maybe it's just.
I think the Surfline app is pretty terrible.
Yeah, the Surfline app is terrible.
It's got this
the
favorites
Surfline
list.
The Surfline website is terrible.
I don't know if anybody else has this problem with the Surfline app, but you can only look at the spots that are your favorite list. So, like, when you were at Cloudbreak, I thought, I want to see what kind of surf Rue's getting. So, I can't search Cloudbreak. I have to add Cloudbreak to my favorites and then always see Cloudbreak.
I will, as a little side comments say that of all of our criticisms of other websites, given how long the list is of stuff that we have to do to our website and how long it's taking us to get it all done, we're probably not in a position to criticize other people's sites.
So on the last episode of the podcast, I spoke about volume to weight ratios and how to find the right surfboard and linking the size of the surfboard you should be riding to your ability. And while we've been away, I have had a ton of emails from people asking for more information and asking a lot of very sensible questions. When I finished the last piece, one of the things that I said is that volume is not the be-all and end-all of surfboard dimensions. It's just the best single one for comparing different surfboards. And as soon as you start looking into more details, everything gets a little bit more complicated. So what I had was a lot of people asking things about, well, what about if it's got a wider nose or what if it's a sort of short, fat board versus a long, thin board? Questions like that.
Yeah.
So I thought I would just go into those details in a little bit more. And exactly as I said, volume isn't everything. The getting the board into the right volume to weight ratio for you and your ability is just a starting point. But this is something that the guy that taught me how to shape and design surfboards always said, you can't surf a cube. If I just take a 32-liter cube into the water, I will not be able to do anything on it. It's not going to work.
Unless your name's Ryan Birch.
Oh, oh. Same gag, different
name.
Did
we say that? Nice.
Well, but even then, so those guys take those guys take squares, but they're not cubes. They're, you know, they are still designed to have a rectangular shape, but thin profile and to glide over the water. If you actually squashed it down into a cube, you wouldn't be able to do anything on it. So once we've got the volume into that right ballpark, we then need to think about the distribution of that foam and also, to a large extent, the rocker profile of the surfboard. In this episode, all I'm going to talk about is the distribution of the foam. We'll maybe cover rocker later on. But
you know that means you're now going to get emails going, well, what about rocker though, Harry?
Because it really makes researching these pieces a lot easier when people send me questions. So the distribution of foam on the surfboard is controlled by three things: the outline of the board, the foil of the board, and the rail profile. Okay, and so this is kind of where you start to see those old traditional dimensions like length and width and thickness coming in.
Could you just explain what you mean by the difference between the outline of the board and the rail profile?
Yes, okay, so the outline, which is also sometimes called the template, is kind of the classic surfboard shape. If you were to lie a surfboard down the ground and then stand above it and look down on it, that outline shape of a surfboard that you would recognize in silhouette. The foil is, if you turn the board and looked at it sideways on, you would see that the nose of the board is quite skinny and quite thin, and as you go down the length of the surfboard, the board gets thicker and thicker and thicker between the deck and the bottom of the board, and then as you get more towards the tail, it gets thinner and thinner and thinner again.
Unless it's one of the boards that well-shaped.
One of the boards well-shaped, in which case it might...
It's just the same all the way down.
Thanks,
I'm
Rube.
Sorry.
Here I am trying to learn.
So in general, what you'll often see is that the outline and the foil actually parallel each other, and as the outline of the board gets wider and wider and wider, you'll very often see the board will get thicker and thicker and thicker. It's not always like that, but that's very often true. The rail profile is the final thing, and it's really just if you were to reach your fingers around the rail of a surfboard, how thick the board is. 1 inch in from the edge, 2 inches in from the edge, 3 inches in from the edge, how it goes from zero thickness to the full thickness in the center of the board.
And now, would the actual shape of the rails be part of the rail profile as well?
Yeah, exactly. But whether the board has a 50-50 rail or a sort of modern tucked under edge, the rail profile can actually remain the same, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. So if you have a board that's 2 inches thick in the middle of the board, and at 1 inch in it's... half an inch thick, and at 2 inches in it's 1 inch thick, it doesn't actually matter whether that's in a 50-50 shape, mm-hmm. or a modern tucked under edge shape. The thickness profile remains the same. If you look at a lot of surfboards, you'll find that some have thicker rails and some have thinner rails, and some surfers prefer one way or the other. But that will affect the distribution of the volume, whether you have a thicker or a thinner rail.
So when you're talking about the rail profile, Would that go all the way to the stringer of the board? Are you talking about that whole sort of the center of the board right up to the rail, or are you talking about sort of the bit that you would be able to touch with your finger and thumb if you held the rail of the board?
Well, so realistically, we're talking about the whole thing. We're talking about that flow of thickness from all the way from the rail all the way to the center. But in reality, you can tend to tell a lot by just looking at the first 2 inches.
Okay.
Well, you'll be able to see how the foam is distributed. Okay, so... when we look at this, my experience in explaining this to people, the best way to start comparing the outline and the foil of boards is to actually effectively break the board in half and look at the nose and the tail as two separate entities, because they do slightly different jobs. And you could almost, if someone built a nice connection, you could almost like swap noses and tails around to do different jobs. Anyway, we'll start with the nose because it's kind of the simplest. The front half of the board is really all about paddling and catching waves. When you're lying down on the board and you're paddling, the board's in what's called displacement mode. You know, the board is sitting down in the water, and as you move through, it pushes the water aside. As you go faster and faster and faster, the surfboard's going to lift up and start planing over the surface. And once that happens, actually, most of the nose of the board, if not all of the nose, is clear of the water and is not actually in contact.
At what speed do you go from displacement to planing? Can I do it while paddling, or do I actually need the force of the wave to get me up to that kind of speed?
So there's I wrote a whole article about this for my website a couple of years ago. There's an equation that will give you how fast any length of boat can go in displacement before it's basically the physics stops it going any faster.
So just to clarify for listeners who might not have this in their head, so when we say displacement, that's like a boat, like a big boat that's sunk down in the water, pushing through the water. And when we talk about planing, you need to imagine a boat or a surfboard that's up above the water, skimming over the surface.
Yeah, exactly. And most planing boats operate in both modes. If you're going slowly, you're in displacement mode. If you're going fast, you're in planing mode. There is then an equation. When a boat is in displacement mode, there's an equation that links its maximum speed to the length of the hull. And basically, the longer the hull is, the faster the boat can go. And I worked out these calculations. And yeah, theoretically, you could paddle up to the point where you wouldn't be able to paddle any faster. Now, the problem is it takes a huge amount of energy to lift you up onto the plane and start skimming. Once you're there, it doesn't take very much energy to stay there, but it takes a real huge impulse of energy to get you up onto the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And so realistically, your arms are not powerful enough. No one's arms. You stick Michael Phelps on a surfboard, he's still not going to get it to actually start planing.
Am I right in saying that when you're in displacement mode, the faster you go, you're using maybe not exponentially, but disproportionately higher amounts of energy, and then the most inefficient a boat or a surfboard could ever be in terms of how much energy is propelling it forward is when it's going as fast as it can, but still in displacement mode, just before it then pops yeah. into planing mode. And as soon as it goes into planing mode, then the energy required as a proportion of the speed suddenly like drops right down.
Yeah.
So when you see those big like super yacht things that are too big to plane, those are pretty much the most inefficient kinds of boats.
Absolutely.
You can see the
yeah.
sort of the massive speedboat shaped ones.
Yeah, they're normally referred to as semi-planing hulls. And yeah, they're horrendous. The amount of fuel burn, I used to deliver those, and the amount of fuel burn you get on them is insane.
Now, does that tie into the paddle speed needed to catch a wave? Is that one of the contributing reasons why your last couple paddles paddling into a wave need to be so strong? Is because you're actually going from displacement to planing going down the wave face?
To a certain extent, yeah. You're using gravity and the push from the wave. What you actually have to do is ride over the top of your own bow wave.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you're using the push from the wave and those last couple of strokes and the gravity pulling you down the face of the wave to get you over the front of your own bow wave. And that's where rocker can really come into play as well. And so we'll talk about that in a future episode.
So it's not just that a lower volume board is going slower and therefore is more difficult to catch a wave. It's also the fact that it's lower in the water. So its bow wave is bigger relative to the size of the board. So you've got more of a bow wave to get over.
Absolutely.
Whereas a longboard, you know, is already almost above its own bow wave because it's floating higher.
Absolutely, yes. Once the board is up and planing, the amount of the board that's actually in the water is very little, and it's only the back half of the board. So all of the front half of the board that we're looking at is now not really in contact with the water and actually is slightly in the way. However, when you're lying down on the board, if you think about when you lie down on a board, you pretty much put the middle of your body, your center of gravity, your center of mass, on the top of the board's center of mass. So for most human beings, our center of mass is somewhere around our tummy button. And so when you lie down, all of your upper body, your chest, your shoulders, your head, all of that weight is supported by the front half of the surfboard. And in order for the board to get up onto the plane, you can't really pop up on the board when it's not planing. It just doesn't really work. In order to get onto the plane, the nose of the board, really it works like a wing. If you think of it like a wing, and the bigger it is, the more lift it generates, the faster it goes. And it has to be able to lift the weight of the upper half of your body out of the water.
So I know that there's not enough data to answer this question, but in your opinion, is there any merit to the idea that people of different body shapes might want surfboards with the volume distributed differently?
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, if you have someone that's been lifting a lot of weights and they're carrying a lot of muscle mass in their upper body, they're going to need more of the volume of the board. You know, weight for weight, they're going to need more volume in the front half of the board than someone who is maybe carrying a lot of weight in their legs. You just want to distribute that volume maybe a little bit differently.
Or someone with a disproportionately massive head like myself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You might want a little bit more foam up front, Rue.
I meant that physically, listeners, not metaphorically.
you know.
Or take it however you want.
So as I was saying, if you think of the front half of the board like a wing, the wider it is, the longer it is, the more surface area there is, the more lift it will generate at any given speed, and therefore the more weight it will be able to lift at any given speed. Now, thickness doesn't affect that. The thicker a board is doesn't change the amount of lift it's able to generate. But what it will do is if the nose of the board is thicker, then it's already supporting more of your body weight. And therefore, the wing needs to generate less lift to bring you clear of the water. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
It's a little hard to describe without any kind of pictures, but
so you're because the board is floating higher in the water, it's going back to that bow wave, it's creating less of a bow wave, so you have less of a hump to then get over.
Yeah, kind of like that, exactly. But it's also you are already sitting on top of the water. You know, if you have a nice big thick board, you're sitting higher up on the water, therefore
you don't have a hole to climb out of.
You don't have a hole to climb out of, exactly. So even if you remove the bow wave side of it. So yeah, that's where thickness comes in. You're using the surface area is lift generated as you paddle, and as the board starts to get onto the plane, the thickness is what is naturally supporting your weight even without paddling. Does that kind of make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of that would seem to suggest that we want lots and lots of volume in the front half of the board, but the downside is that once we're up on planing, as I've said, all of that extra surfboard is now slightly in the way. And the term that we normally use in this surf industry to refer to this is swing weight. So if you imagine as you go in for almost any kind of turn that you're going to do on the board, you're going to bring your weight back towards the fin cluster at the tail, and then the board is going to pivot around the tail of the board. And all of that extra weight, all the way out at the end of that surfboard, has to be swung through a bigger and bigger and bigger arc. And we do a board design lecture each week at the resort, and I set about trying to do some really kind of back of a postcard calculations, and it even really simplifying it, it's about three times the effort to turn a long board through 90 degrees as it is through as it is a short board. And we then had a couple of physics professors from UCSD come, and they sat down and started doing even more calculations, and it was getting harder and harder and harder and harder.
I think we actually have the full calculations as done on a piece of paper by one of those physics professors on our Instagram.
We do.
If you scroll back a little way.
I'll try and link to that in the show notes.
So just to sort of paint that same picture, but maybe in a more intuitive way that people can visualize.
Yeah.
So if you just think of two boards that are of similar volumes, a more conventional kind of thruster type board, and then maybe an older sort of, maybe not necessarily a single fin, but one of those more teardrop shaped boards where there's a lot more volume up at the front, like you might have seen in, I don't know, Busting Down the Door, they were riding a lot of those kind of boards.
Yep.
And then you think about the kind of turns that you see them do and how those turns tend to be, this is difficult to put into words, but the board looks like it's more effort to put through a turn. And then it often kind of like stalls through the turn and then kind of like jumps forward. Rather, when you see a more thruster-shaped board, it's a smoother arc where it's not losing its speed and it's coming around a little quicker straight off the beginning.
Wouldn't that also be a function of the width of the tail as well?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of elements that are going to go into that. But
is that a good visualization of it, or is it?
Yeah,
is that a
I would
little
say
bit misleading?
No. I would say that that's not a bad one. If you took two short boards with exactly the same volume, but you moved all the volume into the front half of one of the boards and all the volume into the back half of one of the other boards, the one with the skinnier nose has, you know, less weight, less inertia out the front. It's going to be much easier to just flick that round and get it pointed in a different direction. The one where all the volume and weight is up in the front half of the board is going to be much more effort to swing that around and point it in another direction.
And that's kind of the logic behind a lot of the, the Evo and those kind of boards, right?
Is to
remove the swing weight from the front.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. On top of that, the extra width in the nose, as the nose gets wider and wider and wider, and I'm sure a lot of people relate to this, it can also make the board a little bit less forgiving when you're going in for a maneuver. If your weight is a little bit off-center or a little bit too far forward, say, as you come down from a turn, it's going to make it much more likely that you're going to catch the rail in the water. You're going to catch your outside rail on the turn as you come around. If you think of a classic shortboard where all of that extra width in the nose has been pulled away, well, there's very little rail to catch in the water. There's very little opportunity for if your weight is a little off-center, it's very hard to catch that rail in the water compared with a longboard. But there's now also no wing at all to generate any kind of lift to get my chest up and out of the water.
And you can see, if you put all that together, how so many of us, and by us I mean like the surfing community worldwide, kind of went down the wrong path in the mid-90s with getting those smaller boards where the maneuver potential was much higher, but the wave catching potential suddenly dropped right off.
Yeah, and certainly, and even, you know, nowadays it's very easy to worry about the restrictions on your maneuverability from too much volume in the front end of the board, and to look at boards and go, oh, you know, I'm not going to be able to do the aggressive maneuvers that I want to, but actually you size that up against the wave catching ability, and you know, I think there's a lot of playoffs.
Just anecdotally, I've been riding a lot of really wide boards this year, and I find that the amount of lift generated off a wider board, you get so much more opportunity to do those maneuvers as well, where with a board with such a small nose, it generating the speed to actually do those critical maneuvers is pretty hard. And if you go down to any beach and you see somebody riding a board that's too small, you see them, there's almost too much downtime in between the maneuvers. And it's just so easy to mitigate that and give yourself more opportunities by increasing the surface area for lift.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, if your board's on the smaller side, especially with less volume at the front, you can potentially, if you're in the right place and presented with the right section of the wave, potentially you can do a tighter, better, more powerful, faster maneuver. But there is going to be far fewer opportunities to try that maneuver.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the front half of the board. Everyone pretty happy with that? Okay, so moving on to the back half of the surfboard. Like I said, once we're up and riding, it's only really the back half of the board that's in contact with the water. So its shape and size is going to make a big difference to how the board feels once you're up and riding. And the one big thing I want to say here is I'm going to be saying tail of the board a lot. What we're really talking about here is everything behind halfway on the surfboard. What we're not talking about is the actual shape of the tail block, you know, whether it's a squash tail or a round tail or a little swallow fish tail. We'll touch on that later, but for right now, we're talking about the entire back half of the surfboard as an entire entity. So the tail, again, it's going to act as a wing. As you're moving forwards over the water, that wing is going to generate lift. And in exactly the same way, the more surface area there is, the more width and the more length there is, the more lift it will generate. Therefore, the easier it's going to be to keep that board moving at slower speeds.
So to just translate into, again, a more sort of like way that people might relate to, if you're paddling into a wave and the wave is not quite steep enough for you to catch yet, and you're at that moment thinking, am I going to get this or not? A much wider tail means you're going to be catching it earlier, and a narrower tail means you're going to be having to wait that extra sort of second or so before the wave lifts up the back of the board and gets it planing. Is that right?
I would say when you're trying to catch the wave, it's really the front half of the board's going to play. The whole board works together, but I would say that the front half is working harder at that point. It's the amount of lift that's being generated by the nose running up against your bow wave is much higher. I would say a better analogy might be as you're surfing along the wave and you run into a softer section, a flatter, softer section of the wave, and the board starts to slow down. A board that has a bigger, wider tail is going to be able to maintain speed, maintain flow when it hits that softer section. Whereas a board that's got a much narrower pulled-in tail, as soon as it hits that fatter, softer section of the wave, it's going to start sinking down and coming off the plane.
So if you surf more of a gun kind of board with a real pulled-in tail, and then you're out there trying to make it work in smaller, softer waves, you're going to find as soon as you try to do any kind of turn where you're putting your weight back, the speed's just going to die straight away.
Absolutely. Now, you bring up a good point. We have surfboards that are deliberately designed with narrow tails like guns, and we have surfboards that were designed with big wide tails, and the reason for that is you need to balance the amount of lift the board is going to generate with the sort of conditions that you're going out and surfing. Mm-hmm. Because the ultimate aim, and we've mentioned this in previous episodes of the podcast, the way that the board interacts with the wave and the engagement of the rail in the wave face is really, really important. And you're sort of almost walking this tightrope between, if the board generates too much lift, if you go out with a really, really wide tail in a really big, powerful wave, the board's going to generate so much lift that it will lose all grip. The rail will lose traction with the wave face, and you're just going to skid down the wave and not be able to make a turn. And you can actually slightly see that if you watch the big wave surfing, particularly just because it was amazing. Watch the Big Wave World Tour event at Piahi that took place while we were off air. I'll post some of the highlights. But if you watch when the guys caught the really big waves really late and they're going really fast, they actually can't bury the rail of the board and do the big turn. And you see them just running out straight. And you think, well, why didn't they turn? And the answer is they couldn't. If they tried to lean the board on rail, they were going so fast and the board was generating so much lift that they would have just slid out. They would have just fallen on their faces. And it's only by controlling that speed to where they can engage the rail that they can then make that swoop back up onto the open face of the wave.
And that's why the tail of those boards are so pulled in and so pointy. I mean, almost like the nose, it's kind of comes to a point.
And they've got this real problem that because the waves are so big and they move so fast, you know, those boards are huge. They're 10, 11 foot long. Some of them are 4 inches thick. The amount of volume in them is massive. And the amount of surface area just from having a 10-foot board is still pretty high. And they try to negate that by making the tail as narrow as possible. But they still have this big wing that's generating quite a lot of lift. And you notice as soon as the guys go to tow boards, and they don't need to worry about paddling into the waves anymore, and those boards are like 5'6". So that they generate much, much less lift, which allows the guys to do all the turns all over the wave face that we see.
And they actually they'll weight them as well.
They do, yeah. Yeah, the boards have lead.
Bite into the water and sink down a little bit. And it's interesting. I mean, one thing that I enjoy playing with in terms of boards, so you very kindly lent me your 6'6 Slayer, which I took out to Fiji because I couldn't get my board for various reasons. And that's got quite a pinned tail in.
Yeah.
And trying to surf that board here at Guiones on a kind of a shoulder high fun day, you can't even really get it to turn. What's the name of that guy we were surfing with in Nicaragua?
My friend Austin.
Yeah, unless you're Austin. I don't know how he did it, but he was like doing off the tops and that thing. But anyway, the point is when you're surfing that board in waist high or shoulder head high waves, it feels so stiff and you can't turn it. And then you go out on a much wider tailed board and it, you know, it's nice and loose. And then surfing that board out at 6-8 foot cloud break, it feels really nice and loose. Suddenly you're going fast enough that, you know, you can do all these carves and turns and it's just a really fun kind of playful board. And if you were to try and take a wider tailed board out there, one guy actually was surfing out there on a Spitfire, you know, the really wide tailed Firewire boards. And it was just skating around, you know, he couldn't really do anything on it. So I always think it's kind of interesting from a personal point of view to have a few different boards so that they almost, from a turning point of view, feel the same as each other as the waves change.
That's exactly right. And the analogy that I often use again in our board design lecture is it's like the sails on a boat. Your aim is always to have the boat moving forwards under control really easy. And so when you have light winds, you put up lots and lots of sail. And if you've got a real strong wind blowing, you reef the sails down, you reduce the amount of sail so that you can continue to move comfortably and the boat sails and responds to the steering input nicely.
Yeah, on the other side of that coin, when I was down in Chile, it got pretty big, and I had a couple sessions where I was out on my 5'2", my little twin fin, where all of a sudden the waves went from, you know, head and a half to like almost three times overhead just in a matter of an hour. And all of a sudden I'm out in these waves, and the tail on my 5'2" is probably 20 inches wide. It may be 19, but probably 20. And all of a sudden it's like, you feel like you're on rails and you just cannot break it off of that axis.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's pretty fun to play with that, and just you get so much lift that you're trying to use more of the rail of the surfboard to actually get that big flat bottom out of the water, and you're having to use every little square millimeter of the keel fins, and yeah, it's good fun.
It kind of highlights the difference in skill between like us normal folk and then say Ryan Birch and Harrison Roach, who are on, you know, 5'1", 5'2" boards in like double overhead Punta de Lobos or Nias or somewhere.
Although, you know, I was chatting with a few of the guys that were surfing with Harrison Roach up at Nias when they were shooting the South to Cyan movie, and they got really big Nias at the end. And, you know, Harrison Roach is an amazing surfer, incredible tube rider. But, you know, they were saying that on those boards that he was riding, you know, he still wasn't as able, he wasn't as able to take off late and make it and get as deep as, you know, the guys that were riding what you'd think of as more conventional kind of step up tube riding modern boards. Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible credit to his skill that he was able to surf it at all. A lot of those other guys may not have been able to. But I mean, yeah, it's not like even he isn't able to make those boards work as well as a pulled in pintail.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, again, going back to what we were talking about before, we've also got to think about that thickness. The thickness of the board, again, doesn't provide any more lift, but it does provide neutral buoyancy. And so again, if you've got if you're running into a fatter, softer section of the wave, and you've got a big thick tail underneath you, again, it's going to survive. It's going to allow you to run out into that softer section of the wave better than a board that's really, really foiled down. But at the same time, when we're now looking at the tail of the board, you also have to think about that you do need, as we were talking about before, to be able to sink and engage that rail into the wave face. And again, the bigger and thicker and fatter the rails of the board and the tail of the board, the harder it's going to be to sink that tail, sink that rail into the wave face. And the balance with this is a very personal thing. You know, some of the best surfers in the world really like a skinny rail. Andy Irons famously liked his rails as skinny as you could get them without the board just snapping, where a lot of other guys, like Michel Berez particularly, likes a really, really thick rail. And the net result is that the thicker or thinner the rail, the easier or harder it's going to be to engage that rail into the wave face. Going back to the shape of the board, that outline, as well as thinking about the surface area, you've also got to think about the shape. The outline of the board makes a big difference to how the board turns. As you bring the weight from your front foot onto your back foot to start the turn, and as you go from, say, your inside rail rolling onto your outside rail to start a cutback, the shape of the outline of the board and the way that the board goes from being wide to being skinny is going to affect how the board initiates that turn. When you go to turn a board, there are two different curves on the board, if you like, that we use to help guide the flow of water and bring the board round in an arc. And the first one that most people think of is the rocker. That curve from the rocker, that lift into the tail, helps define the turning circle of the board. But the other one is the outline of the board, the curve from the midpoint of the board back to the tail, also describes the turning circle of the board. And the tipping point, if you'll excuse the pun, is as you put the board on rail, if the board is more than 45 degrees over relative to the surface of the water, you're going to be turning off the rocker more. If the board is less than 45 degrees to the surface of the water, you're going to be turning more off that outline curve. And so a board that's got a very, very curvy outline, if you imagine a board that had a smooth curve all the way from the midpoint all the way to the back, as you bring your weight back and roll it from one rail onto the other, the board is going to follow that smooth curve, and the transition from one side to the other is going to be very, very smooth. Whereas if we had a board that had a very, very straight rail, then as you roll from one rail to the other, the rail's going to grip and it's going to hold onto the wave face, and then that transition is going to be really quite abrupt.
So would you say that entry-level surfers are going to be turning far more off the outline of the board, and as you get better and better and better, you're going to be turning far more off the rocker of the board?
Yeah, I would say that that's true. And actually, to highlight this, I would say that even on the world tour level, there are only a couple of guys on tour that are habitually turning off rocker. And John is an amazing example of this. Those big, hard, on-rail turns that he does over and over again, even on small waves. He does that because he's turning off the rocker. And if you look at how on rail his boards are compared to even other guys in the heats against him, it's just the dynamics are very different.
So one thing that I always used to be baffled by years ago was I would always get those, you know, the K2.0 fins. Do you remember those really iconic ones that were like blue on the outside with a white circle in?
The circle.
Yeah.
That's great.
And I got those, and I'd see all these pictures of, you know, Kelly Slater doing these massive big power hacks out at Cloudbreaker and Indo. And then I'd use those fins, and I'd find the board would be slipping out, you know, whenever I'd be trying to do a turn. So I'd be like, these fins are too small. I'd put bigger fins in, and then I'd feel like, okay, now I can really lay down a big turn. And for about half a second, I was like, maybe I'm just doing turns that are more powerful than Kelly's laser. And once I'd gone through that, yeah. I realized, oh, well, actually, it's because he's turning off the rocker of the board, whereas I'm turning far more off the outline, which means I'm relying on the fins a lot more. And
you're
these
relying
small
on
fins are skidding through the water.
Absolutely, yeah. Particularly with those Kelly fins, the back fin was actually a tiny, tiny... it didn't necessarily look it, but it was the smallest full thruster template that FCS made in the back, and then the side fins were a little bigger.
Which the Almeric templates, which are really, really popular among high-level surfers, those have the smaller template in the back as well, correct?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it's to the same ratio, but the back fin on the K-fins was the standard, like the old M3. That was the back fin in the K setup. We're getting uber geeky here, slightly off topic. But anyway, so a straighter outline is generally going to result in straighter surfing, where a curved outline is going to make it much, much easier to roll the board from one rail to the other. When you see, a lot of boards have like a little wing or a hip or a little bump in that outline, what it effectively creates is a pivot point in the turn. As you bring your weight past that pivot point, you're going to notice a big change in the turning radius of the board.
Do you know that board that's sitting just outside the door of the office at the moment?
Yeah.
The really long one. It's like a 7-0.
Yeah.
Like a real old-style 70s gun kind of thing.
That's I like that board.
Super like wide teardrop up at the front, and then it goes in. It's almost like an upside-down kind of pear shape.
Yeah.
Yeah, that you guys should all take that out for a surf when it's big out here. It's really fun because you cruise into waves super early because it's got all that volume up at the front, and then it's a single fin, and it's really, really like as narrow as the width of your hand. Like even, a few inches from the tail of the board. And, you can surf it like rail to rail really well. And then as soon as you try to do like a, put your weight back and carve round, that thing just feels kind of crazy. The way it reacts is like nothing, like no other kind of surfboard I've ever surfed.
Yeah. That brings me to the other point about the outline is that the narrower the tail is from rail to rail, the easier it's going to be as you move your weight from your toes to your heels to roll from one rail to the other. Whereas a wider tail is obviously going to take a bit more effort. It's going to be more stable than rolling rail to rail. So we then want to try and find a combination between the curved outline versus the straight outline and the wider outline versus the narrow outline that's going to, create the sort of surfing that we're hoping to achieve in our own surfing. You'll notice at no point here have I spoken about the actual shape of the final tail, the round, the square, the squash, the whatever. And the reason for that is, although those will make a difference, if you ride a board that's got a rounded tail versus a swallowtail, that will be creating a difference. But you're only really going to notice it if all the other stuff I've spent the last 20 minutes talking about is the same. Because that all this other stuff, the outline curve, the surface area of the whole back half of the board, has way more effect than whether the last 6 inches is rounded off or squared off. And there is even one company, they make an interchangeable tail block. So you can take exactly the same surfboard and you can swap the last, I think it's about the last 3 or 4 inches for a squared off one or a rounded off one, and you can then feel that difference. But it's going to be... It's basically going to be the same as like swapping the fin setup that you're riding. And if you're at that point where you're really linking multiple carving top to bottom turns on a wave, you'll be able to feel the difference. But even if you are doing that, I would not ever decide whether a board is going to, make a decision about a board based on the shape of the tail block. Make it on the shape of the back half of the board.
So the effect size of the outline, the rail profile, and the foil is gonna swamp the effect size of the swallow, square tail, or round tail.
Exactly.
But people place a lot of importance on the latter, far more than
huge,
on the former.
Huge.
And do you think that's just because it's a much shorter conversation?
I think it's a much shorter conversation. But I think as well, if you go online or you pick up any book about surfboard design, it talks about, a rounded tail does this, a squared off tail does this. And I think, again, the important that goes back to the old doctrine of surfboard design that we talked about last episode, where everybody rode the same boards. If you went back to the 1970s, everyone was riding those teardrop shaped boards like we've got in the office. Well, so yeah, if you change it from a swallowtail to a square tail to a whatever,
you're just changing one variable.
You're only changing one variable, and that's probably going to make a good bit of effect. But now, where we're all riding all sorts of different shaped and sized, and the shape of the 6-inch tail block doesn't make it a tiny bit of difference. It's irrelevant.
Bazinga.
Bazinga, indeed. Yeah, we could then go into a whole conversation about asymmetric tails and balancing the way that, you know, you load up weight on your toe side versus your heel side, or setting up a board for right hand or left hand points and things like that. Different nose and tail shapes, all the rest of it. But I'm going to leave it there for this episode because I've been talking for quite a while. So my conclusion, I don't want to bore anyone. We'll come back to this in more detail. And listeners, all the questions that you guys sent in to me over the break were really, really useful in kind of compiling what I wanted to talk about in this. So if any of you want to send me messages, podcast@surfsimply.com.
I think if people don't want to get geeky about board design, they're probably listening to the wrong podcast.
They probably are, yeah. Anyway, in conclusion, as I said in the last episode, get the volume into roughly the right ballpark. You know, plus or minus a good few liters here or there. Don't worry at this stage. Get it into the right ballpark. Then look at the nose volume. Look at how much of the overall volume of the board is shoved into the front half of the board. Is that going to help or hinder you as you paddle into the wave? Now, because the volume of the board is largely, you know, once we're up and riding again, volume is less relevant. So if the board, if the shape and size of the nose is going to hinder your paddling, look at the higher end of the volume scale, for the higher end of your ballpark. If the shape of the front half of the board is going to help you paddle, you can maybe think about dropping a liter or two. You know, not loads, but you can drop a little bit within your ballpark. Once you've done that, look at the tail of the board and think about the waves that you are planning on surfing most of the time and how you're realistically going to be riding them. And make sure that the shape and size of the tail is in tune with that idea.
And all of that has to be put into the broader context of what's the limiting factor in your surfing. I mean, is the amount of waves you're going to catch actually going to be the limiting factor? Is that going to be the thing stopping you moving forward? Or is wave counts not a problem for you on this particular day with this particular size and type of wave, and it's some other factor? Yeah. And that's a difficult thing to do. And I mean, this sounds like a plug for, you know, Surf Simply and what we do, but that's where it is really useful, actually having someone who's a coach stand back, look at the way you surf, give you drills and say, this is the thing holding you back.
Yeah, absolutely. So once we've done all that, make the best call, find the best board. I would say, if possible, demo as many different boards as you can. Anytime you have the opportunity, if there's a rental shop near you or near where you go on holiday, go and borrow a board. If they've got something that looks shiny and interesting, borrow it. Go out and surf it. See what you like. Make notes. Have a notebook or a Excel spreadsheet or something of the boards that you've ridden and how they felt and what you liked about them, because every different board that you ride is going to inform your understanding of what you subjectively find the most enjoyable, because that's what it comes down to. That's what a lot of this is going to come down to, is subjectively what connects with you, what feels good under your feet.
I totally agree with Harry. You want to get as many boards as you possibly can, not only to try, but to buy. I think you can't really own too many boards. I think that we're sitting upstairs from a rather ridiculous collection that the CNN guys were here yesterday organizing all around the yard.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's another thing. But no, what I would, one mistake I see people make a lot is take out a board to try it and then make an absolute conclusion about the merits of that board based on that one half hour surf and those two or three waves they've got. Oh, I don't like that board. Or that board was great. So just put, when you're trying out boards, remember that you've only got like that one data point of that one surf. Personally, and this is very much a rule of thumb, just based on practicality more than anything objective, but I kind of say when I want to know how good a board is, really I surf it 30 times. Like I have it for a month, I surf it every day. And then I'm sort of feel like, okay, now I have enough data that I know how I feel about this board personally and how much I enjoy surfing it. After the first 3, 4, or 5 surfs, I don't even allow myself the luxury of forming an opinion.
This conversation just really makes me want some more surfboards. I've been just thinking the whole time. I was like, oh, I can take an inch away here, and I'm going to get this board with this fin set up. Yeah, I have too many boards.
I've bought 5 boards in the last 5 months, and I just saw on Instagram that Alo Alei, our surf shop here in Nosara that has a ton of beautiful old retro boards in it, opened today. And it was every bit of self-control I had as I left the resort this morning to turn down here rather than to turn right and drive over and just check out their fishes.
Your board collection makes me feel a lot less guilty about my paramotor.
When you've got a quiver of paramotors, then that's when you've got a problem.
Yeah, that's when I've got a problem.
listening to the Surf Simply podcast.
So I spend perhaps half my online life just Googling photos of Jerry Lopez's mustache.
Listeners, if you had seen the moustache Will was sporting a few days ago,
yeah,
I wondered where you were going to go with that sentence. There's so many ways you could have taken it.
You got to get the moustache right. It's a very small period of history where the moustache was cool, and Jerry sort of nailed it. Although most people just tell me I look like Freddie Mercury with it, which again is cool, but not what I was going for.
One of the things that I was reading a book recently about modern RAF fighter pilots. Moustache still seems to be pretty key based on the photographs that I was looking at. Like, they're all sporting big tashes.
I always think of like NASA astronauts with that, you know, like Chris Hadfield. He's got a really tight, like short moustache.
What was the name of, was that him who did the David Bowie cover? I just blanked on the name of the song.
Oh, yeah, Space Oddity.
Yeah, Space Oddity.
Space Oddity.
So where I'm going with this, actually it's nothing about moustaches, but in my search for, you know, just general like 70s surf culture photos and things like that, there's one name that I personally wasn't aware of that had a huge catalogue of images from that time, and it's Art Brewer. Matt Warshaw gives a really good explanation of Art Brewer's history and upbringing, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on it, but just to sort of give you an idea, he's from Dana Point, California, and he's a mostly self-taught photographer, and he rose to fame in the surf scene through the 70s, and he was the main photographer of Surfer magazine from about 1968.
He was the editor, wasn't he?
I don't know if he was the editor, to be honest, but he took a lot of their cover shots in one year. It was something like 6 out of 9 cover shots for them. And he also, he worked for Rival Surfing magazine and basically, flitted between those two for the next sort of 10 years. And he, on Brewer's website, I don't know if he's describing himself or somebody wrote it, but it says over 3 decades acting as court painter for the royalty and comrades of the global wave riding culture.
that sounds like the sort of thing that you would write about yourself in
is.
The third person.
It reminded me of when you said about writing posts about yourself on the Surf Simply Instagram page.
I hate doing that.
Founder Rue Hill. I can imagine you sitting at the computer. What am I doing this week? he was renowned for his portraits specifically, and pretty much any photo from that time, particularly the famous ones of like Jerry Lopez or Jerry surfing at Pipe or Al Chapman and you know, that famous photo of him riding the Dick Brewer board in 71 at Pipe. Most of those images were taken by Art Brewer or had something to do with him, whether it was through the magazine or his sort of profile generally. I'll include 2 images in the show notes. One of that Al Chapman shot and a Herbie Fletcher cover of Surfer magazine from 76. And they're both really amazing images. I don't know if you guys have seen them.
So I love that photo, the one you just mentioned of Al Chapman on the Dick Brewer board.
Yeah.
And then he's got, you know, he's got the short shorts and he's kind of like hands above his head and there's like spit coming out the barrel.
Yeah.
And it's one of those old teardrop shaped boards like we were just talking about. It's a super cool photo.
Yeah.
Is Dick Brewer any relation to Art Brewer?
Good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Not related. Dick Brewer was born in Minnesota. They've been, you know, I'm sure it's maybe at some point, but not quite related.
If you ever get the chance, ask Jesse to do an impression of a Minnesota accent. Very entertaining for the non-Americans.
Yeah, Art Brewer was like really loud and aggressive and like 300 pounds at one time, wasn't he?
He's got quite a reputation.
Yeah, he's a pretty wild guy.
Yeah.
My favorite Art Brewer photo is, do you know the photo of Bunker Spreckles on the beach at Pipeline? It's like a blonde kid with a bowl cut. He's on a really short red pintail. And it's like just such an iconic 70s photo. It's Bunker Spreckles is such a, like a crazy story. That's a story for another time. But
we'll make sure that we put all these photos in the show notes for you listeners to check out.
But that just reminded me, for any of the listeners that happen to be in New York right now, there's a screening of Bunker 77, the movie on Bunker Spreckles, and I really wish I could go see it, and you guys can go see it. So
cool. So why did I bring Art Brewer up now? And really it's because I found his Instagram page and all of a sudden 2 hours just disappeared from my life. And I woke up in like coffee stains and 5 o'clock growth. Just like, Where am I? Right now, to date, there's 247 images, and they are pretty much all amazing. Each captioned with who's in the photo, where they were, what they were doing, and the year. You could have just posted Instagram photos with not a lot of information, but the caption is almost as valuable as the image itself. I recommend setting plenty of time aside to scroll through the catalogue of Brewer's work, and assume that there'll be an ocean of Instagramming youths rocking the Lopez moustaches or Grenoff bowl cuts because of this account. Looks like I am aspiring to myself.
I used to have the Greeno bowl cut. I might bring it back.
You should.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
You know who else has an amazing Instagram account, very similar, is Mark Richards.
Oh, okay.
And he, like, some of what he posts is just what he's up to now. But if you scroll back through his account, he posts old photos, but with, like, a whole, like, context of why he was surfing there, where the photo was taken, who took it, what was happening, what the board was, where that board ended up. Like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's really good. He must write diaries or something like that to be able to recall the amount of information he puts in.
Yeah, Mark Richards in his Instagram is, like, the most humble guy in the world. He just, the picture he portrays of himself, he's just so incredibly humble. You'd kind of forget that he won, three, four world titles.
Yeah, he does come across in all his interviews as a very likable, very likable, humble guy. You can see, we were talking about busting down the door before. You can see how he was the guy that, one of the guys that kind of bridged the gap there and was like, hey, we can be okay too. We're not all aggro. What's your favourite photo, Will, on that one?
My favourite, those two are my favourite. The Al Chapman on the Brewer board. I actually have my favourite 10, which I was going to... Well, I've written a magazine article about, but I'm yet to receive permission to use the images for that. But hopefully, if anyone from the Art Brewer studio is listening, you've got an email from me waiting. So it'd be great to run a piece using those photos, because it really is sort of an incredible time of history.
There's one in there from the 5th of September of Bill Hamilton. And he's kind of doing this layback, kind of cut back down at the bottom of the wave. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a non-functional turn that just looks super cool.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of reminds me of Dogtown and the Z-Boys kind of era carves.
Bill Hamilton.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Surf Simply podcast.
All right. Well, I guess it'd be a pretty good time to check in on what's been going on in pro surfing since a huge chunk of the World Tour has gone on since we last convened.
It does. We go away on quite an inconvenient time for the World Tour, because it's like three of potentially the really exciting events on the tour take place while we are scattered to the four winds.
Yeah, exactly. And that's actually a point I'd like to bring up, in that I don't think the WSL storytelling is there yet, because we were traveling and I had a really tough time following the storylines of the tour while I was gone, just because I didn't have the time to watch every heat.
Ironically, the best storytelling from the World Tour usually happens when there's some third party following an individual surfer. Mm-hmm. You know, like whether it's...
Or like that 60 Minutes of Mick Fanning.
Yeah, that was amazing.
The one that always springs to my mind, although it's kind of old now, is the Letting Go with Kelly Slater. You know, that one where it kind of followed him around the world. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, the one where it followed John, the Hurley series.
Yeah, I really like the tour notes as well, but it doesn't really tell much what's actually going on in the event. It's just the behind the scenes, which is cool, but you know, we were all gone and it was a challenge. At our last time of convening, Philippe Toledo and Silvana Lima were midway through just destroying the field at pretty average lowers.
Yeah.
And for what it lacked in the conditions, those two pretty much made up with the best small wave surfing I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when we sort of expected it out of Toledo. He's become renowned for that. But Silvana Lima, who's a Brazilian lady that's been around for a while.
Yeah, I almost thought she was kind of on her way. She was in the back half of her career, kind of on the way out. And then she kind of just came back out of nowhere. She did a bit of an ockie.
She's fallen off tour a couple times and then went and was doing these really solid, big full rail turns, big aerials. I think that was some of the best female surfing I've ever seen. And yeah, props to her for that. But yeah, it was a great event, and it sent a really interesting world title race to Europe, which we'll get on a little bit later. But immediately following the lowers event, the world's best packed up and took a private jet to Lemoore. Did you guys catch any of the Kelly Slater test event there?
Well, interestingly, I was in California while that event was going on. And so I was getting really excited. I thought, well, they're going to run this live. I'm in California. I've got good Wi-Fi. It was stinking hot that day, so I had no intention of going outside. I was like, right, I'm going to prop up and watch this event. And then they didn't broadcast it.
Yeah, they didn't broadcast it.
The only thing you had was, in fact, I think, again, it was at Silvana Lima that was doing a lot of Instagram posts initially. And yeah, it was horrible.
Yeah. I mean,
I was so excited about the event. And then they just didn't broadcast it. Afterwards, I watched the highlights of it and it looked fantastic.
Yeah, it was interesting because it really was just shrouded in mystery the day of event. And I can sort of see that from a WSL perspective. I mean, for me, I really would have wanted to watch every heat. But for them, it's the first real test event at the pool. And I could see if something went wrong or the surfing looked really repetitive or somehow there wasn't the wow factor, that they didn't want that to be the first competitive impression of their pool.
Yeah, it's like the risk benefit of streaming it live just isn't there, you know. Mm-hmm. They're going to get all of the excitement and the buzz, and in fact by not streaming it live they're going to get almost more kind of clouding it in mystery a little bit. They're going to get more excitement building for when they do a live one. I wonder if the gap in between rideable waves is still an issue.
Yeah, I don't know, but it was definitely interesting seeing how it did all then unfold, because Stab started a sort of live blog where mm-hmm. they were linking to all the Instagram and Twitter accounts of all the people that were inside the surf ranch and just trying to build up a whole picture of what was actually happening. Exactly as you say, it almost created its own story.
I did enjoy Stephanie Gilmore's Instagram story from the plane, where it was like there's 32 world titles on board or something.
Yeah,
like
it was clearly the world title plane.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Kelly, Parco, Fanning, uh-huh. her. It was pretty amazing.
Did you guys see the video? I don't know if it came out today or a few days ago, of Jackson Dorian, Shane Dorian's son, at the wave pool.
Oh, amazing.
That kid's going to be pretty good.
He's going to be pretty good. It helps to have Kelly Slater as your godfather.
Yeah, he's got some good surfing heritage that he's been passed down.
But yeah, in watching the highlights, I think the most interesting thing to me about the event was that Mendina won when he was not really in the highlights package at all. You know, he's the master tactician, and he apparently just dominated the event. But the highlights were all John and Philippe. And when you watched Mendina, his was just kind of repetitive backhand surfing. And I don't know, it's just really interesting that when you take the variables of the ocean out of it, that he still ended on top.
So one of the big things that we score highly in competitive surfing is the timing of, well, is top to bottom powerful, you know, mm-hmm. flow-based fast surfing. And the reason it's so heavily weighted is precisely because it's so difficult. You know, to the untrained eye, it looks like the surfer's just going up and down the wave doing the same turn. But actually, you're reading what the wave's going to do and timing when you're going to do those turns. So it's incredibly hard. And I assume they just took the same scoring system and plugged it into this event. But given that you now know, I would assume you know pretty much exactly what the wave's going to do, mm-hmm. I wonder if the scoring should be changed so that there's less weight on that top-to-bottom flow surfing, because essentially it's less difficult because now you know what the wave's going to do, and maybe more weight and the scores should go to doing the kind of things that are going to be more exciting and dynamic and
new and innovative maneuvers.
New and exactly new and
as
innovative.
I believe it
maneuvers.
Says in the judging criteria.
Oh, I think there's so much potential with the format, because it'll be like, I don't know, it'll be like almost how skateboarding is now, that you can have a certain run planned and that's like, that's what you're going to do. But if it's back and forth between you and a competitor, all of a sudden now you have to change the maneuvers that you do, and you can have that plan in your head as you go into it.
Oh, the kid, did you ever, when you were a kid, play skate? You know, where someone does a maneuver and then you have to, you could turn it into that.
Yeah, I mean, there's just
how cool would it be if they had, right, this heat, you're going to be, every wave you get out of, you know, X points, and you have to get barreled, do an air, and do the biggest turn you can.
Yeah.
And that's like the criteria for the wave. So you know you're going to see that combination on every wave. That would be super cool to watch, wouldn't it?
I even like it. I mean, even in free form, it's like the canvas doesn't change, and it's how do you creatively adapt your surfing into that. I mean, I'm so excited. I can't wait for the wave pool in Florida. I assume I'm probably not going to go to Lemoore. So.
I think Lemoore is going to stay as a test tank, isn't it? But I think they're saying 2021 for...
I want to say, I heard maybe 2020 for the Florida pool.
Ooh, shiny thing.
Yeah, I bet that price point is going to be high. There's not much supply and a whole lot of demand.
I'm really interested to see how they monetize it, you know. What you know, because they can turn the wave up and down. They can have higher quality waves, charge more, fewer people, or lower quality waves, warm people, charge less.
Mm-hmm.
And how they balance it all out. It'll be really interesting to sort of stamp, just from a business perspective, to see if they can find a balance that works.
Yeah.
Or if it ends up being something where the wave pool doesn't really make money, and then it's all about the peripherals. And,
yeah.
You know, it's all about the cafes and perhaps the restaurants and things that are kind of around it and shops that are around it, and that's making the money, and the wave pool's just the draw.
I can very well see that, because, I mean, I bet the cost per wave is going to be really, really high.
Mm.
Interesting. I tried calculating that. I know we're getting off CT surfing a little bit, but someone sent me an email about all of that.
We asked listeners to send us in, and we had a few listeners that sent us in the cost per wave from their recent surf trips.
King Out, someone was asking about the cost, like what is the cost per wave just based on the electricity usage.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I don't know how big the generators are that Kelly Slater is using, but Wave Garden did say that they were using a 400 kilowatt generator to make their waves. And if you run from that, it's actually not very much at all. I think it was, I want to say it was 80 cents based on California electricity price. It was 80 cents a wave.
But that's just a fraction of the running costs.
And you've got to try and recoup, you know, $10 million of investment to build the thing in the first place. But yeah, it is interesting actually how little it costs in electricity to create a wave.
And it just looks like when you see the, especially now that there's a lot of video available of the wave, there's this massive train running along with you at the same pace of the wave. So, I mean, I would just imagine it takes a lot of energy to get that thing going.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I say, this is based on Wave Gardens 1 that was all hooked up to, you know, a ski lift setup. Yeah,
either way, I think it's such an interesting time to be in surfing, because this will change the game completely. You know, it's going to change surfing, and yeah, I can't wait to see it.
I don't think that we've personally got any connections with any of the guys working on the team at Kelly Slater's Wave Ranch, but if anyone out there is connected with it, we'd love to chat with someone involved with the project on the show.
Mm.
So, yeah, reach out.
Just as a wave pool aside, Andy, who I'm coaching this week at Surf Simply, does the majority of his surfing inland in Austin, Texas. And he goes out there with specific skills, and he gets to work on it again and again and again. And he's done a bit of ocean surfing, but pretty limited. And I was really impressed with how his surfing's translated into the ocean. And that's that's the goal of his trip, is to adapt his wave pool surfing to the ocean, because he's going on a big surf trip this week. So that's been a really, really fun kind of coaching goal for the week.
Could well be a shift. I mean, we could see in 50 years where most surfers aren't in the ocean hardly at all, and going to the ocean is just kind of a treat, a bit of a luxury that you do now and again for most people.
I feel like there's a lot of North Shore quotes we could drop in here. Rick Kane. But anyway, back on to the CT. After the Lemoore event, the men's and women's tour moved to Europe, which I think is really weird schedule-wise, that women's Qashqai runs before the France event, that men's and women's Portugal event are not run simultaneously.
Personally, I think the fact that the women's Qashqai is run alongside a men's 6,000, I think,
mm-hmm.
at Qashqai, but the fact that the women have to surf there and the men get to surf Super Tubos.
Yeah, that
right?
doesn't...
That sucks.
Yeah, that's a bad deal.
If you read all the notes for the beach there, it's all like, yeah, it's pretty windy, really popular with windsurfers, average waves.
They've just never got good waves for that
event. Do you know why the women aren't at Super Tubos?
Sponsorship, I think. This is the Qashqai event is, because it's very close to Lisbon, it's sort of the closest reliable surf beach to Lisbon. And so it's always been their big event. Kind of like the World Tour used to go to Fistral in England.
Fistral in England.
Ugh.
But yeah, I personally would love to see Tyler Wright at pumping Super Tubos. I think that'd be amazing. And I think it's about time that we get that switch.
Yeah.
But regardless, Nicky Van Dyke won the event, and Tyler Wright appeared to suffer an ACL tear. And was said to be out of the rest of the year, but then just showed up next week in France. So pretty much every surf mag reported that.
I think it's scientifically accurate to say that the Wright family are self-generating like Wolverine.
Yep, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, usually that ACL injury would have you out, but she's a Wright, so
yeah.
She's kind of just dealt with it. It was just okay.
Why doesn't the same thing happen with Mikey Wright's hair?
That's pretty good. Did you guys catch any of the France event?
Hell yeah.
That looked good. And it was right in front of the house that we, the last 4 or 5 years, we've always stayed in.
Yeah.
And then, and we've been like, oh, it'd be cool if they run the contest out the front of the house here so we could just watch it from the porch. And then they always end up running it way up the beach. And yeah, this year I saw the drone footage and it was like, ah, oh, it's right there.
Yeah, they
right
just there. Kept constantly panning to the backyard.
Yeah.
I was like, this is amazing.
I think this was one of the best years of in France.
I do as well.
We've had in a long time. Yeah, like the sandbanks are incredible. They got a big, like, long running swell.
Beautiful sunshine, offshore winds.
The storyline of the world title was pretty strong with John and Jordy coming into the event. Well, they came into the event nearly tied for the yellow jersey. Jordy had a slight edge on it, but then totally flopped at the beginning of France. I mean, he looked like someone that just the pressure got to him.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys caught much of his heats, but he really looked like he was dialing it back to about 60%. He was not doing world title surfing, which is a shame. But John fully capitalized on it. He didn't just win heats. He decisively won heats. He had something like a 17-point out of 20 points for the listeners. Heat score average, which is pretty unheard of.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, his average for the year is like in the 16 points. I think it's the highest average heat total ever.
Yeah.
Whenever you know, we talk about John surfing and how consistent his performances are, I always come back to an episode we did ages ago about the difference between explicit and implicit learning. And one thing that really stuck in my mind when we were talking about it was how if you learn something implicitly, which means, you know, just as a child playing, basically, mm-hmm. trial and error without really thinking consciously about what it is, as opposed to explicitly, which is, you know, usually when you're an older person and you have someone explain to you how you do something, this is how you should serve or do your turn or whatever. When you learn something implicitly, it's far more resistant to cracking under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know if this is really true of all the surfers on tour or just more so of John, but I feel like, you know, he learned so much of what he now does as an adult, as a young child playing, you know, out at Pipeline and in the beach park there. And that may be true of everyone. It's just that he had more exposure. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like, I wonder if that's a factor, you know, when he's under pressure, it was just learned implicitly so young.
Yeah.
And so it's all of that muscle memory is buried under so many more layers mm-hmm. that it's a lot harder for the pressure to get through and affect it.
To crack into it.
Yeah.
And then he ran into Gabriel Medina in the semifinal, which is
unreal.
An unbelievable heat. Yeah. It was amazing. Gabriel Medina actually ended up getting the edge, but once again, it was not because John cracked. It was just...
That was the one heat I caught, and it was a nail-biter. Marina and I were like on the edge of our seats, like fists clenched, like, ah!
What did you guys think about the Medina flip? Was that a... Because it was a completion, but he had kind of a bobble and a mistake midway through.
Yeah, it's tough, isn't it? Because
when I do those, I like to do it. Arena, but.
I feel like, you know, the location as well has to play into it slightly. Mm-hmm. You know, that those French beach breaks, it's not like going for that in the bowl at Macaroni's where you know that the waves can do the same thing every single mm-hmm. time. You know, those waves are so unpredictable. To go for a maneuver like that and land it, mm-hmm. even if there was a little wobble in it. Like,
I just kind of thought back to the Kelly Slater air at Lowers a couple years ago where he did this crazy big backside spin, but he fell off midway through and he ended up flipping and landing stomach down on his board and getting up immediately. And they gave him like a 3. Even though it was one of the most exciting moments of the year, it wasn't considered a completion.
Yeah.
Now, Mendina's feet barely left the board, so it wasn't quite to the extent, but you know, was it what he was originally going for? And how do you score that?
Just side point, when I was out in Tavarua, there was one wave that just stood up all the way down. It was kind of a smaller day, super, super glassy. And I've never done this, and I've seen it on films a couple of times, guys kicking through the back of a wave, but still standing on their surfboard. So like the camera's under the water, they kick through the back and they're standing on the board. The wave goes over and then you rise up out of the surface through the back of the wave, still standing in a surfing position on your board, and then you sit down. Mm. And I've never done it. I just thought, oh, that looks cool. And the wave was closing out and the water was so perfectly clear. I thought, I'm going to just try and do that. And So I jammed the board really hard into the wave. And then I was like, oh, I'm going to come off. So I crouched down and I grabbed hold of the rails. So at least I was going to stay on. and then I got pulled back up over the lip, and I went over the falls backwards, upside down, and then I landed on my feet on the board, on the flats in front of the wave, and then I kind of wobbled a bit, and I fell off, and I was like, that was the most bizarre thing that's ever happened to me on a surfboard, and I paddled back over to the boat, and the surf guide and the boat driver was like, that was a sick barrel roll. And I was like, yeah, that's how I do that sometimes.
Yeah, a little perfect. Anyway, but Mendina ended up taking the heat, and he took the win, which was pretty amazing.
It was. I just, that whole event was so good. Like, the surfing all the way through, it was so exciting. Very rarely do you look at the, like, end-of-day highlight package from the WSL, mm-hmm. because they we've spoken about this before, because they removed the storyline and all the rest of it, it's just a bit bland, it's just surfing and music. But actually, for that event, there were sort of two or three days in a row where just that highlight reel of the best waves ridden mm-hmm. with music under it.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. On the women's side of the draw, I thought Carissa Moore absolutely dominated, which is really good to see. Because in my opinion, I think she surfs at kind of a different plane than everyone else. And it was good to see her in that form and good to see her dominating. She beat Lakey Peterson in the finals.
Out of curiosity, I would definitely put Carissa Moore, Tyler Wright, Steph Gilmore, yeah, maybe even kind of Courtney Conalog up in that top tier that are very much separated from 90% of women surfers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I would put Carissa Moore. I don't know if I would separate her from Tyler Wright.
I would separate Steph and Carissa from everyone else. I think that Steph surfs in a more feminine, elegant way with more power than has ever been done. And I think on the other side of the coin, I think Carissa surfs with more raw aggression than any female surfer ever has. And I think Tyler Wright is elite as well. But when you put Carissa and Tyler next to each other, like, I'm just thinking of some of Carissa's free surfing clips, and I know she had one in Morocco last year. She just leverages her body so powerfully. And she does it with a lot more flow than Tyler. The connection in between her maneuvers, I think, is a lot more effortless. And when she's on, I think she's unbelievable. Yeah, and it was good to see her just dominate, and it was interesting to see her surfing contrasted with Lakey Peterson's, who Lakey was up until she met Carissa was putting up 19-point heat totals. And she was doing so with really innovative maneuvers, yeah, above the lip spins and stuff, but it just looked kind of rinky next to Carissa.
Well, Lakey Peterson is the other person I would maybe put in that elite category as well.
I think that the judges need to be very careful with Lakey Peterson because they're scoring her on innovation because they haven't seen it before. But I don't think it's on, you know, when you look at how Savannah Lima does the maneuvers, she does them, you know, a stratosphere above Lakey Peterson. You know, whereas Lakey's grabbing the board early and in spinning, Savannah Lima does it above the lip. And just the difficulty comparing those two, it's... you know, so much harder to be doing, you know, a tail high reverse above the lip than early grabbing it. So I'm worried they're not giving themselves much room with Lakey, and they're not really promoting much innovation. Because if she's already getting nines for doing these early grabs, there's not much incentive for her to be pushing these maneuvers further.
But maybe it is giving incentive for the rest of the field to start doing them.
Yeah, but there should be incentive for them to, I mean, if you go down to Guiones this afternoon, there'll be 3 15-year-olds that are doing much better airs than the ones Lakey was doing in France.
It's you like, mean guys, not girls?
Guys, but Leilani McGonigal in Costa Rica does, you know, much more aggressive airs than Lakey Peterson. So at an elite level, I don't think it should be scoring the way it was.
They can recalibrate the scoring heat to heat, you know, certainly mm-hmm. contest to contest.
But if you get a 9.5 for doing a maneuver that you know you can make and it's quite easy, there's not, you know, there's 0.5 scale to push above it to do the tail high reverse.
Yeah, but you have that. I mean, we saw the same thing with the air reverse, didn't we? Like, in fact, I think, was it Medina that came on and just had that really solid air reverse? Like, could land it every single time. The judges scored him really high for it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he got away with a couple of easy heat wins because he would go out and do that and get a high heat score. But by the end of the year, everyone on tour could do an air reverse. Now Medina doesn't get away with just doing an air reverse. He's got to do a very clean, buttery, smooth air reverse.
Even the same thing happened when the, I can't remember who it was now, but when the 360 first came in, like 20
yeah,
years ago.
Yeah, 360 spins were pretty yeah. in vogue.
So I think you're absolutely right, Asher. But I think it's not a concern. It's just a property of how judging works, and I think it'll kind of sort itself out in the wash.
What about judging within a certain heat, though? So let's say that you had Lakey doing a reverse like that and getting a 9.5, and then you had Courtney Conalogue, someone who surfs, or Tyler Wright, someone that surfs with a ton of power, doing these big, powerful maneuvers that are just objectively more difficult.
Yeah.
And now you're judging a pretty, I don't want to say easy, but a less difficult air reverse, and you're pushing the scale up here where, now what kind of power surfing does Tyler have to do to beat her in the heat, even though those are more difficult?
Well, but as long as you are putting weight onto both, then obviously the ideal would be to see Tyler doing those huge rail turns and finishing with an air reverse.
So what did happen when Lakey Peterson met Carissa Moore?
Well, she didn't have as good a heat as she did earlier, but Carissa pretty decisively won in that.
Yeah.
And the women's world title race heading to Hawaii is amazing. Now, it's basically you have Tyler Wright, Sally Fitzgibbons, and Courtney Conalogue all nearly mathematically tied once you take away their lowest event. And essentially whoever goes the furthest in the final event of the year wins.
Oh, that's always a good way to finish the year.
Yeah.
I hope they get good Honolulu for that showdown. Like, I hope it's... because last year was a bit uninteresting. Like, the waves at Honolulu were a bit uninteresting, but... was it 2014?
Mm-hmm.
When it's pumping. I hope it's like that. That would be amazing.
Yeah. So finally, final little bit of contest news. The men headed to Portugal, and one of our coaches, Harrison, was actually at the event.
Yeah.
And he confirmed that Super Tubos is actually, like, much heavier than it appears.
Really, really heavy.
Yeah.
And actually, the waves in France, at the Gravier are really heavy, too. I mean, those are some of the heaviest waves I've seen anywhere in the world, even when it's not that big. And super unpredictable, because close out on you at any second.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I thought that the waves that they got in Portugal, that was pretty much like the ideal contest.
Yeah.
It had
The whole European leg has been so good this year.
So good. Yeah, they scored massive waves at the beginning. And then at the end, it was kind of that head high range that you could get barrels. And they also did the big aerial maneuvers. You kind of had just opportunity to, surf to whatever strengths you have.
Those round one conditions were amazing. Yeah, I wonder how many of the guys were sitting at, like, when that swell showed up, I wonder how many guys were worried that they didn't have the right boards in their quiver. Because that was, there were some solid,
some
12 to 15 foot faces at Super Tubos.
It's detonating.
That was huge.
Yeah, but once again, Jordy didn't capitalize and John did. Pushing through the event, looking dominant in most of the seats. I thought Chloe and Dino looked really good, a bit of a resurgence. Chloe eventually knocking out John and Mendina taking another win. So went 2 for 2 on Europe after winning the Kelly Slater event. So it's been a pretty good
couple
months.
A late season surge.
Yeah, late season surge. I don't think many people saw that coming.
So where are we at now with the men going into Hawaii?
Jordy's basically mathematically out. He conceivably can win, but the scenarios needed for Jordy to win are pretty limited. It's more or less John and Mendina. If John wins,
that's the showdown everyone wants to see.
That's the one everyone wants to see, and that's the one that we can. I hope it just spurs into a nice rivalry, because you could ride that one for the next 10 years.
Yeah,
but yeah, if John makes the finals, he'll win the world title. But if Mendina wins and John gets less than third, then he'll win, and that's pretty conceivable. At Pipeline, Mendina's pretty good there,
and John's never won it.
He's never won.
So, could this be actually Kelly Slater's last year on tour? Or just a conversation that has been had every year for the last 20 years. But do you think this is going to be his just very quiet, unexciting, like, Irish goodbye out of the party?
I mean, he's out, isn't he? He's not surfing Pipe.
He is surfing Pipe. He's back, in the Pipe heat draw right now.
Okay.
I mean, he's still a credible threat at Pipe.
Did you guys see the footage of him in New Jersey last week?
Oh, yeah.
There's a massive swell in New Jersey, and Kelly Slater showed up, borrowed Sam Hammer's board, was surfing in a Billabong wetsuit with Billabong stickers, and he's just getting piped.
There was a photo from a surf shop in New Jersey of Kelly Slater buying Outer Known clothing.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah. But yeah, so heading into Pipe, it's a pretty open world title race still. We got Kelly Slater in the draw. And yeah, the Holly Eva contest starts next week.
Yeah, it's interesting because Medina hasn't been in this world title race. As we came out of Trestles, it was Jordy, it was Julian, it was Owen. Medina has had a very average run and was like mathematically in there, but really not.
Not even in the conversation.
And the way that France has rolled through is amazing because it's, as you say, it's John and Gabby.
Yeah. I don't know. I honestly think that this rivalry could be taken for the next 10 years. It's just John's too likable to spur a light rivalry.
Who are you guys rooting for?
Oh, John.
Will?
John.
Harry?
I would like to see John win at Pipe. I think that would be insane. Like, can you imagine what the crowd's going to do when John wins at Pipe?
Yeah, I'd like whoever to win, I'd like to see. It'd be cool if they met up in the semis for the world title.
Oh, yeah.
If John wins, it'd be the first back-to-back title since Slater. Was it 07, something like that?
So
did Fanning win back-to-back? No, Slater won. Yeah.
Do you think that... who you support in any kind of sports contest is always just a very non-rational gut feeling, and that's the fun of it, right? And I wouldn't want to pull that apart in the same way that you don't want to deconstruct a joke because it stops it being funny. Do you think that if we were all first language, Portuguese was our first language, that we would just connect more with the Brazilian surfers and therefore find ourselves subconsciously writing for them more? Just because in all those little interviews and on all those little times that we'd heard them speak, there's just not that linguistic barrier. So you have a more intuitive access to their where their head's at, and that builds up over time and there's more of a connection. Or do you think that John just is more of an inspirational surfer and human being, and that's why, you know, we find ourselves backing him?
I think if it was John and Philippe Toledo in the running, I would very much struggle to pick a favourite. I really like Philippe Toledo.
I think it's that Medina kind of portrays himself as the villain.
Uh-huh, yeah, a little
which
bit.
Is okay. Andy Irons did it with a lot of success in the 2000s, but Medina, he does not care what you think about him. He just wants to win.
I think as well, John presents... We were talking about Mark Richards before. You know, John presents himself so well. I mean, he might be maybe he's a horrible person to sit down and, like, have a beer and try and play a game of cards with.
Yeah, I don't think
but
he is.
I don't think...
Sit down and play a game of chess with.
The persona that is presented that the world sees is of such a likable, interesting, personable human being. It's really hard not to get behind him. You know... Even if you remove the fact that he's such an amazing surfer in the water. Whereas, again, possibly this is cultural, whether it's a language barrier or just a, you know, cultural difference.
I find the machisto puffing out of the chest, who's the bigger man, very like off-putting from anyone from any culture, whatever language they speak. I find that immediately makes me sort of like, just want to take a step back and put a bit of space between me and that person, whether they're someone, you know, in my life or whether it's a celebrity or a sports figure.
Yeah, and I find it very hard to get behind someone who's a bad loser.
Yeah.
Medina has shown himself to be in various different ways, but has shown himself to not be a particularly good loser. And it's one of the things that makes me like watching Kelly Slater compete is that, you know, way back when there was no contractual obligation, he would always give an interview. Whether he won or lost, he would always do a post-heat interview, and most surfers wouldn't. I think it makes a huge difference. So just to wrap up the CT, we've obviously had three events while we've been off air for the men and for the women. So our fantasy... Actually, a lot of people now are playing. I noticed we had 250 people playing our men's fantasy game.
And I think I'm at about 249th at the moment.
That's awesome. Yeah. I love that so many people have jumped into the clubhouse.
Yeah, it's really cool. Anyway, Yoshi JP, I think I'm pronouncing that right. Yoshi JP won the Trestles event for the men. Partridge Bird won France, and The Small Boys won Portugal. Caldemac is in the lead overall for the men's league. Good Food won Trestles for the women. Dogtown and Mike's Picks drew for the win at Portugal. And Eddie Sun won France.
Eddie Sun!
Congratulations, Eddie.
Yeah, lives down the road.
Yeah.
Or lives some of the time down the road. He's an international man of mystery, I'm sure.
With a very good moustache right now.
Oh, is he sporting the, is he sporting a Lopez?
Yeah,
it's probably
is.
How he won the event.
That's probably how he won.
Alan's picks, you are in the lead overall on the women. So good luck, everybody, going into the last event. The women are competing at Honolulu on November 25th. The men will be competing at Pipe on December 8th. But, of course, we've got the Triple Crown, which will kick off on November 12th for the men at Haleiwa. All right, that is nearly all we've got time for. The last thing, as always, is our What to Watch section. My pick, randomly for me, this is normally something you boys would have chosen, but I've chosen a Deus Edit, the Scramble Gamble, which for me is everything that South to Sion should have been. They've hit the narration style. It's got that like Bruce Brown feel to it that I really like. I mean, the jokes are corny and terrible, but I love it. It's brilliant. I want to be a part of this trip. I want to be a part of that gang of friends, and I just didn't get that same feel from South to Sion. So well done, Deus. I think you've nailed it on this one.
When that trip was going on, they were driving through motorbikes in Lombok, and I was actually in Lombok at the same time. And I think I was surfing at the same time that a lot of that was shot.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, they're pretty funny guys.
Yeah, they're a nice bunch, those Deus guys.
Rue, what's your suggestion?
Well, actually, I picked a movie on Vimeo called Kai Lenny by Steve Aoki. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his last name right, A-O-K-I. And it was just cool. I mean, it's just showcasing Kai Lenny on all different kind of wave riding craft. He's on a windsurfer, a kite surfer. He's riding massive waves. He's doing flips and small waves. He's riding crazy little beach breaks on a hydrofoil. And, you know, I think sometimes the being an all-round waterman card is played when people are... I've got to be careful how I say this. I feel like sometimes people try and undermine great surfers by going, oh, well, they're not an all-round waterman like me sort of thing.
Yeah.
But Kai Lenny really is an all-round waterman. And again, it does it with so much humility, so likable. Like watching Mason Ho, he just looks like he's having fun and not taking any of it very seriously. I really like surfing, and some of those other sports don't appeal to me as much because I don't like faffing around with equipment. I love the simplicity of grabbing a board and jumping in the ocean in your trunks. But watching this video made me so envious of the fact that I'm not a windsurfer and a kite surfer and all this other crazy stuff that he does. Just a really fun video. Put a smile on your face.
Very cool. Will?
So my What to Watch doesn't contain any surfing, but instead FireWire did a little one-minute video about how they turned the waste from their CNC machines into paving stones. And they, in the video, they showed that a Kelly Slater Gamma, the waste from making that one single board, makes 1.5 paving stones that they've then used at the Kelly Slater Wave Ranch and at their headquarters. And it's a way of for them to kind of become a zero waste company, which I thought was quite an interesting goal for
them. That's really cool. They've mentioned it a few times on their podcast, The Wire, which, you know, listeners, if you haven't heard it, you should tune in. It's really good. Chris Groh does a great job interviewing people, but they've mentioned a few times that you know, their push is to be a zero waste company, and I've got a lot of respect for that.
Yeah.
I wonder what portion of the production process creates paving stone. Like, what part of the waste is it?
It's the foam, and they basically put it into another machine that... makes it way denser, some kind of a heating process.
Cool.
And they literally heat the product and then squeeze it into the mold of a paving slab.
So it's sort of looks like a plastic tile.
Ah, cool.
A plastic floor tile almost. Asher, what is your what's your What to Watch?
Well, this week is 7 years since the passing of Andy Irons. And after he passed away at the Surfer Paul Awards, they showed a really, really moving film about him. So my What to Watch is it's kind of the In Memory of Andy Irons video that Surfer Magazine produced, and it puts chicken skin on me when
I love watching Andy Irons surf.
Yeah.
He's one of those guys like John that just is beautiful to watch.
Yeah.
It's such a bummer that his surfing happened just before the advent of high definition cameras, or at least before they were ubiquitous.
Basically, the Kelly Slater Andy Irons rivalry occurred at such an impressionable age for me. I was just consuming every tiny little bit of surf info when I was like 14 years old. So I grew up with that rivalry, and when he died, it was really, really sad, and it kind of struck me. So that is my What to Watch this week.
Very cool. All right, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the show. As I said before, if you would like to reach out with any comments for me, you can reach me through podcast@surfsimply.com. You can reach the other guys through their social media feeds. Roo, how do we get hold of you?
I am simply Roo Hill on Instagram and Surfing Simply on Twitter.
Asher?
I am King Asher, King_Asher on all your social media feeds.
And Will?
I am at Will and the Water.
On Instagram. Yep. Very cool. And if you have enjoyed the show, then please do share it. Play it to someone in the car. Give us a rating on iTunes. All of those things do help other people to find the show. And the more listeners we have, the more we can leverage all you lovely people to try and get some cool interviews.
And if you go to surfsimply.com, a couple of the new things that are up there now, we've got our new apparel store up there. So we've got custom designed women's swimsuits and men's board shorts, which we're all wearing right now. Yeah, and there's rash guards as well. We've kind of redesigned the rash guard in a way that we think is pretty cool and stylish. And yeah, so go and check that out. And as I mentioned before, we've got the Tree of Knowledge up there now as well, which you can just search for in Google, or it'll pop up in the slideshow on the homepage of the website, and you can click through, download that as a free poster as well.
From all of us here then, ladies and gentlemen, goodbye.
Bye. We love you. Bye.
That was the Surf Simply podcast from the Surf Simply Coaching Resort in Costa Rica. For more about Surf Simply's video coaching courses for experienced surfers and technical coaching for entry-level surfers, go to surfsimply.com.